I have with me today Jamie Meyer of the Society for Shamanic Practice and of Drumming the Soul Awake. And he and I are going to have a discussion about stuff, shamanic, about holding space and about the invisible work that we do as human beings. So before we begin, what we'll do then is, as always, we will open sacred space. So if you will, if you're listening in on this, if you will, then send your attention out or face east if you can. And then we will invite those spirits who wish to come and participate in this conversation to come and be near us. So spirits of the east, you who are the ones who nurture and nourish and midwife that which is new within us, that which is untried and growing and unsure, come and be near us, surround us, and participate in this conversation with us. Lend us your power and let your wisdom be known here. And then if we turn and face the south or send your attention out to the south, spirits of the south, you in whom we find the fullness of all that is, the heat of high summer and the brightness of noon, come and stand beside us. Put your hands on us. Imbue us with your wisdom. Come and be part of this conversation and let yourselves be known. And if you'll send your attention out to the west, spirits of the west, you who prepare our eyes with the softness of twilight for the darkness of what we do not yet know, come and stand beside us. Be with us and let your wisdom be present in this conversation. And then sending your attention to the north, spirits of the north, ancestors, 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 grandmothers and grandfathers, all the way back. Come and gather round us. Stand beside us, guide us, guard us, and teach us. Let your wisdom be known in this conversation. Spirits of above, shed your light on us. Grandmother Moon, Father Sun, Star Nations, our ultimate ancestors. Show us the path, enlighten us. And Earth, our mother, Earth, our mother, Earth, our mother. Remind us always that it is your belly we dance upon, and with grace we walk upon your skin. So also remind us that we are bone of your bone, blood of your blood, breath of your breath. And make your wisdom known here in this conversation. So may it be. Right then. So I have been exploring recently with a number of people the invisible work that humans do, and particularly us as shamanic practitioners. And one of those aspects of the visible work is holding space. And so I'm just really curious what you think about holding space, because I am pondering it as a form of intention and trying to put into words what it is that I know about it, because I know I do it all the time, but what is it that we're doing when we hold space, or who is it that we're being when we hold space?
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic, I think one of the things one of the first things I think about when we mention that phrase holding space is, you know, like when we do shamanic work or any kind of spiritual work, so often we are dialogue or in conflict with our inner voices from the culture, and the culture. The voice that I hear, the culture says, well, holding space is so inactive and it's such a waste of time, it can't be real. You know, and so there's so much in shamanic work that the cultural voice says that can't be real, right? And holding space is one of those, because we're, you know, we're this culture of activity, of doing, of, you know, outward flowing energy constantly, and of measurable results and things like that. So holding space is pretty difficult, you know. I mean, it brings up the same kind of ideas, I think, as the difficulties of meditation and silence, and you know, it's so antithetical to so much of the voices from the industrial mindset. So that's kind of the, one of the first things I think about, you know, is the voices that say, oh, that can't be real, or what a waste of time.
Yes.
And yet, the other thing I'm thinking about, it's kind of specifically personal for me, but it may resonate with people. You know, I have a teenage son who has been struggling with depression, and for a while, for a little over a year. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, if you've been through this with your own children or with somebody you love or yourself or whatever, you know that it takes this incredible amount of resolve to be patient and resolve to be still, sort of like with depression. And I think with many other, you know, illnesses or chronic illnesses or whatever conditions in life, a lot of times all we can do for somebody is just be present, right? And when we talk about being present, actively being present for somebody, that's a form of holding space. And so, like, I've kind of over the time here learned that there's really not much I can do for my son. All I can do is hold space. And so, like, in my prayer work and in my own kind of like energy, you know, there's so much of me that wants to reach out and like fix it or, you know, make something better or change something or whatever. And I really can't. I mean, I'm really functionally pretty powerless as an active agent in his journey at the moment. And so all I can do is hold space. And so when I think of it, as I am powerless, I can do nothing, that is a really nasty place to be. But when I think of it as all I can do is hold space for my little boy, it's very, you know, maybe it's like, you know, like so much of, you know, this work, maybe it's just a mind shift, maybe it's the placebo effect, maybe it's the changing your frame of reference or changing your story as we talk about so much. But it really, really helps me when I think to myself, I'm holding space for my son. And in that way, I'm keeping my attention alive. You know, I'm keeping my eyes open to see, well, is there anything that I can do or should do? But most of the time, the answer as I'm holding space for him is no. You know, there's really nothing I can or should be doing. All I can be doing is trying to, you know, hold a container around him or around our life or whatever, and try to then, to the degree possible, ask Spirit to fill that container with whatever the right energy is for both of us, you know, for me to maintain patience or equanimity or whatever, and for him to move along through this journey that he's on. So I think about that with holding space.
Yes, I agree with you completely. That is such a valuable thing. And having dealt with depressives in my family and suffered from depression myself, the value of just holding some stillness energetically around the person is hugely valuable. There's tremendous healing power in that, just in the willingness to not trample in over the space that the person needs and attempt to, you know, shake them up and get them back on their feet and, you know, what's wrong with you? They've had that conversation internally already.
That's right. Yeah, they're already doing that themselves, and they don't need, you know, he doesn't need me to be yet the other voice doing that.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, once again, though, it's like, I guess for me, it comes down to, I can view that as I'm powerless and I'm stuck and, you know, I'm so frustrated. Or I can view it as I'm holding space for somebody who I love. And just framing it like that has really helped me.
Yes, I would think so. Because you're pushed yourself by the same cultural stuff that's pushing him in his own head, you know. And that
right. And in that way, you know, I mean, like we talk about this in our shamanic work, how, you know, all of our life situations present us with a possibility of learning something new or learning something deeper. Oftentimes those lessons are quite uncomfortable. And this is a great lesson for me of how to not be the fixer, how to not be, the active one, which I'm so often, in that way, as a teacher or whatever, I'm always designing this and thinking that and marketing this. And, it's all this active world, and so it's a great, great lesson for me, an uncomfortable one, but a great lesson for me to also be in that stillness. And in that way, I'm holding space for myself as well as him.
Yes, so, very much so. So that you become more practiced in simply, I think what I was brought up considering from the Quaker point of view, practicing the presence of God. You are just practicing being present to whatever is and holding the presence of divinity at the same time of the sacred.
Yeah.
Which is,
it's so huge. And it's one of those, many things, I think, in probably all spiritual practice, but certainly in shamanic practice, it just sounds so dumb. It's so simple. It can't possibly be true. But like so much of the powerful work we do is just opening and being present, holding space. I'm thinking about so many of the elongated ceremonial work or meditative work. Like, for example, I've been to Peru a few times and, the teachers there talk about, going to sit on the mountain for 7 days and seven nights. You hear the same thing coming out of Native America and, many, many places in Buddhism, going to sit on the mountain. There's that old Japanese koan or phrase, a poem. I can't remember. It's by Basho or somebody else. But he says, I sit and I'm going to slaughter this, of course. But I sit for a long time. I gaze at the mountain until the mountain and I become one, right? And that's that kind of, that Japanese aesthetic. It's like so simple and beautiful and true. But it's like. In our world, what holds space? What's a better example of something that holds space than the mountain? If you've lived around mountains, I grew up in Colorado, so the mountains were outside my window all the time, and I always feel like internally the mountains are always holding space for me, even though now I live in the prairie and there's really not a hill to be seen where I live now. But for me personally, the mountains, as one of my teachers said, the mountains were my first protector because that's the landscape I was born into. And so the mountains are always holding space internally for me. And there's times when I feel really wrecked and I can return to that and I can go, the mountains are always holding space for me. I've been to other places, other landscapes, Scotland and Peru and other places where the mountains are so vibrant and so present. And you really feel like, these mountains are always holding space for us, who are standing here at the moment.
Yes, definitely. Another thing that occurs to me about holding space, I keep finding it in my mind paired with holding intention, because they have that so drummed into us as shamanic practitioners that you don't do anything unless you have stated your intention and you hold to it, and it's the horse you ride, it keeps you on track. But I am beginning to see those two things as two sides of the same hand, really, where holding space is perhaps the feminine version. I don't mean for women, but I mean the divine, the sacred feminine version of intention, where you pull back all those things that trample over you and just hold them back and allow spirit to do whatever it is that spirit is going to do. And so your intention in that situation is to allow spirit to do, is to allow. Whereas the other sort of intention, the horse you ride as you go out on a journey, is a much more male, outward moving, absolutely vital piece of shamanic work as well. But I do think that the whole holding space thing goes unspoken and in many cases untaught. But when we talk about the hollow bone, becoming the hollow bone or the hollow reed in hollowing out for spirit, we are actually holding space, aren't we, for spirit to be present here in me.
Right. You have to. Thanks for all that. That's really beautiful. Thanks for saying that. You have to have a container for power to flow through. Otherwise, power just disperses in every direction, which can be okay. But even in that way, like you think about the ocean, you think, oh, the ocean is power dispersed in all directions, but not really. It's contained just in the container is so big that we can barely comprehend it. Or the solar system, or you know, the galaxy. These are all containers of power. And our body is a container. When you talk about the hollow bone as a working metaphor, that's us becoming a container so that spirit can flow through. And one of the things I was thinking about before we talked was, you know, years ago I used to work in the theater, and I worked, well, I did a lot of things. I worked as a playwright for a long time. But before that, I was really interested in lighting design. And when I was in college, I had this really wacky lighting design professor who was on the cutting edge, and he started to introduce us to working with lasers in theater work. You know, this is like a long time ago. This is like even before like laser light shows, you know, became popular and stuff like that. So he convinced the university to buy these two or three little lasers, and we created our own little laser light show and stuff like that. But so I just remember him talking about the laser as this, you know, contained light, you know, like when you look at a stage light. Like there's different kind of stage lights. There's these stage lights called Fresnels, which are kind of big floodlights, and they flood the whole stage in kind of a soft ambient light. And then there's these other lights called Leicos that are more contained and brighter, and they're like, you know, and they can cover certain areas, smaller areas, but more intensely. And then you have spotlights, you know, that can really bring up a huge bright light. You know, and the laser is like the most contained form of light, you know, so in that way, the laser can operate on a relatively small amount of energy, but that energy is aligned because of the container that it's in, you know, and then the relatively small amount of power can be focused because of the container. As the energy is running through that container, it focuses it and it bumps up its effectiveness. So that's kind of like the hollow bone idea when we talk about that, you know, we become that container of laser energy. We bring in this kind of ambient energy that needs the container to focus it, and it comes out the other side very effectively. And in that way, like, you know, you can send the laser to the moon, or you can cut through steel or whatever. So, yeah, so everything needs a container in order to focus energy.
Yes, and we're very used to, in this culture, not being the container, but filling whatever is empty. So,
yeah.
I noticed that in myself, you know, that the thrown-ness here is to fill silence. It is to fill an absence of anything with busyness, to fill all of our time with busyness. And so it seems to me that then holding space is very much counter to this culture, as we've said, and that part of the reason that it seems invisible and is not something we speak of very often is that there's very little overlap between what is culturally known and this notion of holding space, that holding space then looks invisible, like it doesn't actually exist, because there's very little hook between it and our culture as it stands in the Western industrial world.
Yeah, it's interesting you're just saying that. I was thinking about how it's so counterintuitive, and I'm not even sure if I can kind of articulate this correctly, but like you're talking about the culture wanting to fill all empty spaces. But what it wants to fill all empty spaces with is more dispersed, frenetic, ambient energy. And so like meditation or prayer work or silence or whatever, so often when we talk about meditation, we talk about entering the spaciousness, right? But like spaciousness is not the same thing as the void, because in meditation, the way that I experience it in my work anyway, when I enter that spaciousness of meditation, I actually think what it's doing is, in some way that I don't probably understand or I can't articulate, it's actually aligning energies in a way that cannot be aligned like when you're talking about the traditional masculine energy of you know, lining it up yourself through your own intention or through your own you know, visioning or whatever, that's us trying to line up energies. And like you said, it's really good. We have to do that as human beings. But the spaciousness of silence, the spaciousness of holding space, in a weird roundabout way, it actually aligns these energies in ways that we can't, and I can't explain it beyond that, but I'm just thinking that as you're talking.
It seems to me that there is a way of shaping this, and I'm really out on the edge of what I can articulate, but of shaping the space that we're holding. Not so that we are forcing something to happen. You can't do that. You're not holding space if you're forcing something.
Yeah.
But that as a sort of an invitation in the space, there might be a particular shape. Or maybe we just get better and better at holding genuine open space. Yeah. I don't know. But it does seem to me that I have a friend, a practitioner, who was taught the difference by her spirit guides between holding compassionate space and holding healing space.
Oh.
Where I think the shape of the space is different is as if it is imbued with an intention. So you hold the space with the intention for healing, or you hold the space maybe with just the intention for, you know, compassion washing through it, and whoever is there receiving just the relief of pure compassion. If no healing particularly is needed, or I get the sense from that there's a lot more about holding space that maybe I don't know.
Well, it's such a huge and beautiful metaphor. Like I'm thinking about, you know, in the Celtic world, one of the fundamental images in Celtic war, Celtic shamanism, if you want to call it that, is the image of the cauldron. Right. You know, which we have kind of passed down to us as, you know, the witch's cauldron, you know, that the old witch stands around, or the three witches stand around cackling and stirring and bubbling and boiling. But that cauldron out of a shamanic tradition is one of the primary images of working with spirit. And it's the cooking pot. So the idea is, you know, the cast iron cauldron. It's suspended above the fire, so you have the source of life heating the cauldron. But then the cauldron is the container, but then the food is whatever you put into it. And so the cauldron is in its nature empty and receptive. It's like what you're talking about with the divine feminine, like the womb, or you know, the any kind of womb is the cauldron. You know, it's receptive to what is put into it. So if it's carrots and beef and broth, you know, it becomes that. And if it's, you know, whatever else, it becomes that. But when we talk about holding space, I can't help but think about that image of the cauldron and how popular and how powerful it is in Celtic tradition. And so when you look around and when you realize, like what we're saying earlier, that it's just the nature of how this universe works, I guess. You know, we have bodies. You know, everything has a body, and a body is a container. It's a cauldron, and so like your body or your cooking pot or say ceremonial space. What you said earlier is like every container is just the receptacle for what we ask to be put into it. And if we ask for the field of healing energy to be put into that container, then that's what it holds. That's what it cooks. If we ask for the energy field of compassion to be put in that container, that's what it holds and that's what it cooks. I'm thinking now about, you know, in our world, there's different sizes of containers. You know, you might say that, you know, an atom or a molecule is a kind of a container, and you know, the galaxy is a container. The whole universe is a container. So on and on it goes. And but what you said a while ago about holding sacred space and our part of it may be asking what kind of energy is poured in to that cooking pot. You know, back to like when I was talking about my son. So like, you know, what you were saying was making me think, well, okay, I say to myself, I'm holding space. But I can ask myself, well, what kind of space am I holding for him? You know, and so it's a good question to ask. So I'll, you know, after we get off the phone here, I'll start asking myself that, see if it drives any other energies for me.
Yes, definitely. I think that there are subtleties to that unfolding of space that I'm fairly certain that our distant ancestors knew all about, you know, and had mastered. But I haven't mastered them, well, you know, because I haven't inherited them, so I didn't grow up mastering them. Yeah. But one of the things that does strike me is that almost every time that someone, I listen to a recording, you know, where someone is starting a call or they're saying you're going to be doing this work, and they do say, get yourself into that neutral state of being, that neutral mind, or what one of my teachers called an innocent mind. Which has no predispositions about how things need to be, and where you've held at bay, you know, your own opinions and your own urgencies and the bumper car nature of this culture that we live in and of the energy of the world that we live in, and just let yourself be present to what is there, and that seems to me like the starting place for holding space. So if we're instructing someone who doesn't know how to begin, how do I start doing that? Then I would say start there. Start by somehow moving yourself into that neutral space. How do you do that when you move into a neutral frame of mind about something?
Well, it's interesting as you're saying that. I went back to what you said earlier about the divine feminine. You know, to me, what I'm hearing right now, or how I'm kind of putting it together for myself, is when we start in that neutral place, I think we're saying, help me to become the divine feminine, the empty, receptive holder of the energy that has to be there. Otherwise, there can't be any food cooked. You know, there can't be any nourishment if we don't have the pot to hold it in. So maybe that neutrality. My teachers talk about a lot about neutrality too. And I'm not sure they would think of it as, you know, primarily driven by the divine feminine. But I don't know. I've never asked them that. But it seems really possible or I don't know. It seems right to me. Like, you know, allow yourself to become the divine feminine, the receptive holder, that is at the moment, as empty as it can be, of the small energies that are driven by the human mind and by the human ego. Those are the small energies. Like, those are like, you know, whatever, the little stinky vegetables that you don't want in your soup. and then there's an assumption there, and a trust in spirit, that because the divine feminine and masculine are always working together and they're always dancing and kissing and flowing together, that when we allow ourselves to enter into that receptive divine feminine place, it activates the divine masculine to pour in what it says, I know what this soup needs. You know, this soup needs some of this. And then you become the marriage of the masculine and feminine. But you have to be the pot first. Otherwise, there's nowhere to pour in that divine masculine energy that has, in my view of thinking about it, the divine masculine has the higher forms of intentions for us, the higher vision, the broader vision. And so, like in my prayer work, you know, I ask the sky world or the divine father, the, you know, father sky, whatever, you know, to pour in that larger vision that I can't possibly comprehend because I'm a small human. But so those two things meet, the container and the food, you know, for lack of a better word.
Yes, absolutely. And I would put forward that the container has roots through the analogy of the cauldron immediately begins to break down, but it does have roots through which intentions, songs, plans, creative thoughts, all those things can also enter the mix. So they really do have the marriage of the divine feminine and the divine masculine right there, because you've got what comes in from the divine masculine, you know, and you've got what rises up from the divine feminine, and they are always dancing together and embracing and parting and, you know, coming back together and doing the whole business, which is great.
Yeah.
Exactly what you want.
Yeah, you know, there's this kind of changes the direction of our conversation, but I was thinking about, you know, when you first mentioned this conversation, I kind of mused on it. I'm thinking about, you know, another element of this is the tension between constraint and freedom, right? So a lot of times in our spiritual work, we talk about enlargening the container or enlargening the space that we're holding, you know, and that's the ongoing work of building our power and building our skills, is that we become bigger and bigger containers for spirit. And so there's this tension between having a container and what, kind of like the beautiful things we're just saying, oh, I'm going to be empty and divine feminine, and oh, you know, spirit, pour in your intention. But there's a point where on our journeys as human beings, the container is filled and it gets too small. And this is what our initiatory experiences are about, is in some way enlarging the container, which sometimes means the container that we're in either has to be gently dissolved until we, you know, understand that, oh, there's another layer of container, you know, just outside that and with more space. Or sometimes the container needs to be broken. And sometimes we, you know, we break the container for all, you know, sometimes out of impatience or sometimes because we need to. But so there's this idea about the holding space as a safe place that's contained so spirit can pour in. And then there's the other part about space being held that starts to become a constrained place. That's part of dealing with holding space, is sometimes, oh, we have to open it up more, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about this. And, you know, this image comes back to the idea that, like, when we're conceived in our mother's womb, that's a container. And soon enough, we become too big for that container, and we have to leave it. And so we have the simultaneous, like what one of my teachers calls the two, you know, primal fears of being human, the fear of entrapment and the fear of abandonment, right? And they come at the same time, because here we are, as we get bigger, we're like, oh, this is so great, this is so nice. And then like, wait a minute, this is starting to feel really tight. And so we feel, oh, I'm losing my freedom. And I'm trapped, you know. But then when we're born, then it's like, what the hell, man, you know. And it's like, where did my safe little womb go? And then it's the fear of abandonment. And we carry those two fears with us. So those fears are involved in this whole idea about containment, holding space, negotiating with the size of the space that we're holding, negotiating with, you know, whether we are able to hold the current amount of space that we're trying to hold, that kind of thing. The ideas just go on and on.
They do. And one of the things that I hear echoing in that is this whole notion of requesting dismemberment as a shamanic practitioner, so that, you know, whenever I am doing a piece of work, whatever that may be, one of the first things I've been taught to do is to go and request to be dismembered, so that there is a chance to enlarge the capacity.
Yeah.
I think I would suggest that, you know, so that you drop any hucha that you're carrying, you know, cause you've been dismembered, and then somehow you're remembered, into some form. And hopefully then that form, has a larger capacity for holding space, for carrying power, and or else what would be the point? That would be my question for going through that, really. I think, but it seems to me that there's a resonance, an echo of the same thing, you know, happening in dismemberment and in this whole business of just enlarging the space, just, you know, gathering more power, stretching ourselves, and breaking the container, and then having to.
Yeah, and then it's it's helpful for me to remember that, like, when the container is being broken or dismembered or deconstructed or whatever, the point is that you're, for example, like when we're in one of those, you know, tornado storms, and like everything is like just getting ripped apart, you know, like divorce or job loss, things like that. And we, you know, if we're spiritually minded or if we have this set of imagery, sometimes we can say, oh, you know, I'm in a dismemberment place, you know, or I'm in an initiatory place, or I'm in this, you know, place. It's helpful to remember that the point, like as you said, the point is I'm building a bigger container. The point is not really the tearing apart or the dismemberment. That's just the pathway toward recognizing now the bigger container that I've been poured into, and I have more room. So again, it helps me to understand to the degree that I can, you know, when you're in those kind of storms, that, oh, I am actually getting poured into a larger container. It doesn't feel like that at the moment, for sure. It feels like everything is just kind of, you know, going to hell. But it's just one of those little, again, like mindsets, like, you know, and you can even put that into your prayer work, like in the midst of that storm where there's so much happening, and, you know, anger and regret or fear or whatever. And you can put it into your prayer work to say, Spirit, this is really hard. Help me to understand that I'm being poured into a larger container, and help me hold that space. Help me learn how to hold that new space, that new larger space. You know, these are things that sometimes can be helpful. Oftentimes, you know, they're just barely helpful. But even if it's just barely helpful, you know, that's still some help.
Well, even if you just have a moment where you go, oh, that's what this is like. You know? Yeah, I have had those where you know, you're being completely just the skin flayed off your body, it feels like. You know, and there's a moment where you go, oh, that's what it's like.
Yeah.
And then you're back in the being played. You know?
Right. And then that moment, like you said, if in that moment you can be like, oh, okay, because this new fresh power is getting poured into my container. It can be helpful. Or I hope it can be helpful for people.
Now, you mentioned prayer work there, and I'm glad that you did, because I'm really exploring the invisible work that we do. I remember being told in my practitioner training, now when we turn you loose out of here and we let you go on the world, you know, seeing clients, that's going to be the tip of the iceberg, you know, for practice. And me being bitterly disappointed because I was going, oh, come on now, that's what I wanted to do. After, you know, a couple of decades, then I am actually very much aware that it is the tip of the iceberg of what I do. Yeah. That and teaching tiny bits, you know, everything else that I do is invisible to the outside world.
Yeah.
So I think that the mentioning of prayer work is a very valuable thing. Because that's a thing that I have had impressed on me from Spirit is a really important piece of our work.
Yeah.
That conversation, that ongoing, bold, confident conversation with Spirit about what we see and what we see is needed, and what we see as a possibility in our lives and in the world. You know, would you like to say something about that?
Well, I think, back to our kind of core image here about holding space, you know, the container. Prayer is an ongoing work with your personal container. You know, I mean, prayer is a form of containment. So for example, like on a structural level, you know, like when I get up, like the first thing I do in the morning is, you know, make my prayer work. And really the last thing I do at night is make my prayer work. So those two prayers, and then, you know, I have prayers during the day, but those two prayers that I feel like I cannot miss those. Mm. And you can think, well, that's, you know, because of discipline or, you know, or like, you know, if you come out of the old religious institution, you're like, oh, that's just because you've been, you know, imbued with the guilt. But it's not that. It's that if I don't have those two prayers, then my container is wackadoodle the whole day. And so the prayers build my container. They reinforce it. If it's been battered or poked at, you know, by the world, if it's been, you know, penetrated by, you know, hoochah, I'm trying to make hoochah an adjective, by hoochatic forces, you know, if it's been penetrated or poked or whatever, those two prayers, the beginning of the day, end of the day, repair my container. Mm-hmm. If I don't have that, then I'm not operating well, and I can feel it. I can just feel it during the day. The prayer is all about, you know, holding space, holding your own space. And it's also about when you're doing prayer work, it's understanding that you are being held in a container. Like spirit is holding space for you, and prayer acknowledges that. You know, like, you know, Mother Earth, you know, is like one of, you know, my kind of core prayers is just standing outside and thanking Mother Earth for holding me. You know, thank you for letting me stand here right now, you know, on your skin and be held by the trees and the clouds and the, you know, the arc of the sky and the, you know, the wind. Thank you for this container, you know, thank you for this body that came out of your body, you know. So much of prayer work and what we talk about gratitude, you know, gratitude is about, you know, recognizing the container that is being held for you by powers greater than you. And the prayer work is so important in terms of strengthening your own container.
That is that is a step into, very much like the step out of adolescence and into adulthood, where you recognize that you then have to begin to take on responsibility for yourself. Because very much when you're, what I've found in my life, when I was flailing around and really hurting and not functioning well, oftentimes spirit would just step forward and hold me. I would find myself in a place, you know, where I was suddenly being held just to give me a little relief, you know, so that I didn't fall apart entirely. And then being trained, you know, I was being held. The degree to which I was being held, I don't think I knew. You know, but I had this expectation like a child of being held. But there comes a point where you must take on the responsibility for reinforcing that container by calling your attention to it, you know, in prayers, that when you do your prayer work, that's one of the things, one of the many things you're doing, is calling your own attention to the fact that you are being held by spirit. And by doing that, then the spirits step right up and go, oh, yes, I'm doing that, yes. But if you don't, like you say, your container is pretty wackadoodle, and mine certainly is. It begins to go into a very weird shape, and I don't function nearly as well. I do much the same thing that you do in the morning. You know, there are specific things that I give my attention to, one of which is this land right here, on which I live and which holds me and everybody, and into which plant teachers show up, you know, just spontaneously as weeds, you know, things like that. And also in the middle of the day, you know, I take just a moment to thank, you know, the sun and my ancestors and, you know, the bees and everything for life. And then at the end of the day. And that does, it's like tent pegs around the edge of it, you know, the edge of a tent. It stops blowing and flapping.
Another way of kind of phrasing what we're doing with that prayer work. You know, shamanic teachers talk about the need to care for and feed your spirit guides, and you can actually put that into your prayer work. You can say, you know, your spirit guides or Mother Earth or whatever, I'm feeding you this energy, this love, or like I work with tobacco, so I'm, you know, feeding you this tobacco so that you can be strong. Because, you know, then you hold my container. So, you know, like that helps me. So the gratitude is kind of like that, an easier way of kind of, or it's maybe a less specifically shamanic way of talking about, you know, feeding. Well, one of my teachers says, you know, we have to feed what feeds us. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to protect what protects us. That's that cycle, you know, that reciprocal cycle of gratitude. And so the prayer work, you know, you're bringing in the core element of trust, like we've said. You trust that Spirit is holding you. And the prayer work, sometimes, a lot of times, my prayer work has helped me trust because, like, I'm having trouble trusting at the moment. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is, when you say help me trust, you're saying help me strengthen my container, you know? And that Spirit often, you know, does, you know, well, I would say more than often. And so the same thing, too, when you talk about the plants appearing or your Spirit guides or whatever, you can all, when you make prayers of thanks to them, underneath that is also an affirmation that they're always working to repair your container. They work in secret. Like you said, you know, most of our work is in secret, and a lot of their work is, you know, most of their work is in secret, you know. But it's not a bad idea to include in your prayer work, you know, to your guides or to the land or ancestor, healthy ancestors or whatever, you know, help to repair my container, you know, help to strengthen it, or help to prepare me for when the next enlargement of my container is coming. Help prepare me for it now, you know, so it doesn't have to be such a rough journey when it comes or whatever. That can be really helpful.
Yes, definitely so. I'm very taken with what you're saying about the constant cycle, you know, of feed what's feeds you. That is such a that resonates all over the globe with people who are indigenous. That is to say, they belong to the place where they live. That part of everyday ceremony is actually giving back to Spirit, when Spirit is what makes the land live and gives us food and air and water and all of the things that make for life.
Yeah.
One of the things that we can give Spirit is beautiful language and song. Well, which doesn't, I mean, there's no straight line between song and the earth being fertile, you know, and the rains coming at the right time. And yet, I would conjecture that, you know, it's all related.
Yeah. Now I've lost my train of thought. You said something and I'm like, oh, I want to say this, and now I completely forget. But yeah, there's no straight line. What I was going to say is, you know, a lot of when we talk about, you know, loving the land or feeding the land or, you know, putting prayer energy or something into the land, a lot of times people, when they think about that, they think about wild places because it's what's beautiful to them. But one of the great gifts for me, it's been kind of frustrating and a gift also, is, you know, I live in the middle of a big metropolitan area. I live on a busy street. You know, many times a day, you know, the police cars or ambulances or fire trucks go down my street because it's a big street. I live not too far from the airport, so depending on how they route the planes, I often have pretty loud planes flying over, you know, every 90 seconds for, you know, several hours. So, you know, it's really urban, you know. But I've learned just this incredible lesson of rather than like putting my attention outward onto the beautiful places that I visited and the wild places that I've been, you know, that hike that I took last summer, and putting my attention there, I put it on my kind of like, you know, little backyard that is, like you said, full of weeds. You know, I've done some landscaping, but, like, you know, it's certainly not a, you know, Martha Stewart, you know, mansion. But being back there every day for my prayers and thanking this land, again, thanking this land for holding me and my house and my kids and my work, since I work out of my house, thanking this little bit of land in this loud, sometimes stinky, not very, you know, beautiful, poetic environment a lot of times. Doing that work for me has been so transformative. I think there's a pretty common hope or aspiration or fantasy for shamanic workers of, you know, like, oh, somehow I will, have the money or whatever, and I'll move out of town, I'll buy my, you know, place, I'll live out there, I'll, you know, get my retreat center or whatever. And some people do that. And I thought about that years ago, and I'm like, yeah, you know what, I'm never going to have the money to buy the retreat center, I don't think. You know, maybe that's me, you know, not being, you know, properly attentive to my intentions. But the other part of me is like, there's something really powerful for me about being right here in the middle of the city. And I've worked with shamanic teachers in a couple of places, you know, in the non-industrialized world that are even louder and more frenetic and more just like messed up than my neighborhood is, you know, I mean, and they just, you know, they do their work in their in the living room or in their little room downstairs that they have set aside. And it's really loud, like little motorbikes, you know, sputtering by and, you know, people shouting and all this stuff. And, you know, they're centered right there, you know, they do their work. You know, and so it's been very, very important for me in terms of the container. Again, like this is my container, and rather than like always have an underlying desire to leave this container, which is a way of saying to the container, I don't really respect you, you know. And when you say that, you know, the container, you know, shamanically thinking, you know, spirit, you know, can get kind of offended, you know, just like if you said to your spouse, every morning when you woke up, if you said to your spouse, you're all right, you know, like you're okay.
That's gonna do well.
it's gonna make that relationship go super well. you know, but so just that thing of, you know, here's my container, and I praise it, you know, in all of my prayers, I praise it, you know, amidst the variable, you know, pleasures in it. And I think that has been, I don't know, maybe I'd be dramatic enough to say that may be the most important lesson I've learned, is to praise the container I'm in first, and then start asking, you know, is there something next? Because there's something about building that power that's really important.
Yes, I have for a long time, I remember being told in my most fundamental training that you'll be journeying in upper world, you'll be journeying in lower world, we won't be journeying in middle world. And my immediate bodily response was, but that's where things happen. That's where I'm interested in.
Yeah, that's, you know, really.
And it's that same thing of being exactly where you are, because I do think that there is an inbuilt Western, and possibly it's really North American, but I don't think so. But it is definitely North American. Thought that just over that next ridge, that will be the place where I will find myself rooting. You know, I'll root down into that place. I'll be indigenous there, but not here. This is, you know, it, I don't know if it's a frontier mentality or if it's because we cut ourselves loose from Europe when we left there generations ago. In my case, on my dad's side, it was seven generations back. Mm. You know, they cut themselves loose from Highland Scotland during the times when it was really, really, really bad, and they came to North America.
Yeah.
Well, then what happens? It's like a tree. You've just cut the roots off. You know, it's very difficult. So this, I really have always held all of my life, this idea that I would find a place where I would be at home, and it would be spontaneous, and I would just know it. And the only way that I have found a place where I am at home is by doing exactly what you've just described.
Yeah.
You know, going outside my back door for now, it's been about a year and a half now that I've been doing this, maybe 2 years, and actively thanking this piece of ground right here in the middle of town, you know, with all of its good things and bad things and, you know, whatever, for holding me. And the more I do it, the more I see how held I am by this particular piece of ground with its number of trees and the way that their roots go under the ground and they connect up via the mycelia that are there. And it's been really transformative. And I've done a lot of transformative things in my life, you know, put myself in the way of it. But this has been deeply, fundamentally transformative.
Yeah. Thanks for saying that. You know, what you said is true, about the frontier mentality. And it goes back to that, those two core fears of abandonment and entrapment. What you're saying about the North American mindset, the cowboy mentality, you know, that expansionist thing. And it comes down to, I'll say this, I may regret saying it because 5 minutes later I might say, oh, that's not really true, which happens to me a lot. if there is a difference, a core difference between what I would call, you know, Western mentality or white people mentality or whatever, and the indigenous worldview, Like my people have a core energy of I don't belong here, and Indigenous people have a core mentality of I belong here, or I belong here. You know, and you know it's in the Western religious tradition that we don't belong here. You know, it's the world has fallen, and so even being born into the world, you're into a place that you don't really belong. You know, home is after death. Home is elsewhere. So that's one of those really core patterns in Western industrialized culture that is a core part of our cultural illness, I would say. I mean, it's brought us gifts. You know, the creativity in the Western mind for newness is, you know, really in a lot of ways unparalleled, I think. But we're always ready to abandon and be abandoned. And then when you look through, when you talked early on about all the distractive energy that's poured in, all of that I think comes down to that we have built an ongoing core pattern for our lives of we are going to abandon at any moment, and we will be abandoned at any moment. And when we're left alone, in silence, though, that fear comes raging up. And so it's like, fill it up with Netflix, you know? So yeah, that's pretty big.
It is really big. And fighting it, I think, is not helpful. Like with anything, because whatever you fight, what you resist persists. You give it energy because you've given it your attention. You know? Yeah. So fighting it, not good, but doing the stepping sideways thing and then creating your own indigenousness, whatever that word is, with your own land where you are, I think might be a thing that we could do. Yeah. That is to say, I would invite anyone who's listening to this to try that and see if that doesn't give you some balm for that place in your soul where you are constantly on edge and ready to flee for fear of being rejected and abandoned.
Yeah, you know, if all ground is sacred ground, and where you are is the container that you're in, you know, we talk about, you know, we protect and we defend what we love, and we're pretty much taught, you know, not to love wherever we are right now, because like you said, there's a better place and I'm going there as soon as I can, you know, do it. That's a transformative idea that, again, sounds kind of like really big and also kind of like, well, so obvious that it can't be true, you know, but it's so true, you know, like if each of us praised our yard or praised the patch of grass, you know, that's nearest to us, as a sacred container, that's transformative.
Yes, very definitely so. Wow. Yeah. I'm just going to stop there. I think I think that's the thing, you know, that really we were aiming for in this conversation. So thank you for saying that.
Thank you. Thanks for opening the open the container.
I'm so glad we got to do this. We will do it again. So what I'm going to do now is to say thank you to you. And thank you to the spirits of the East and of the South, and of the West and of the North, and the spirits of the overarching sky and of our Mother the Earth. Thank you. Thank you for holding us. Thank you for informing us. Right. And we will talk again. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.